Good morning. Welcome to this public on-the-record session on the future of the U.S. military presence in Iraq. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And I'm very pleased this morning to have not only a distinguished panel, but a panel which represents a very wide range of views on the subject at hand. I hasten to add, however, that when I reflected on this subject this morning, I realized that it's a subject a little bit narrower, maybe, than it should be. Somebody participating in a meeting the other day here at USIP said, well, you know, the real issue isn't just the military presence. The real issue is whether Iraq needs more international help or less international help. And I will urge the panel to give us some hints, at least, about how you see not only the military presence in Iraq, but what else has to happen on the civilian side, not only with U.S. civilians, but also more generally with the international community, because I think those are important elements in thinking about this operation, which is in some sense less and less military in its objectives and more and more political, diplomatic, economic, and has many other dimensions as well. We're going to start with Kim Kagan, who is the president of the Institute for the Study of War and the co-author of New Reality in Iraq, author of a forthcoming book on a military history of the surge. We'll go to Colin Kahl at the Center for New American Security, co-author of Shaping the Iraq Inheritance. Then to Charles Knight, co-director, the Project on Defense Alternatives at the Commonwealth Institute, author of Quickly, Carefully, and Generously, The Necessary Steps for a Responsible Withdrawal from Iraq. And then to our, what we regard as our very own, Randall Rahim, though we share her these days with the Iraq Foundation for sure, who is an Iraq fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I hasten to add one word. You will receive more official notice by email, but we believe that we will have Minister of the Interior, Jawad Bolani, next Wednesday, July 30th, here from 10 to 11:30, a bit of a late July surprise, and we're very pleased to host him for a presentation and then Q&A in our normal fashion. Kim, let me ask you to begin. There because of the cameras.
Excellent. Good morning, all. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's a pleasure to be here to talk with you about the future of the U.S. military presence in Iraq. I returned last week from a trip to Iraq again. I spent about 12 days on the ground in a 14-day trip. That is my fourth such trip since May 2007. So since then, I've had about 40 days on the ground in Iraq at quarterly intervals. And I'm always struck each time by how different Iraq is. And looking back to May 2007, which was the peak of violence against U.S. soldiers, and indeed my first trip, I feel every time as though I'm in a different Iraq, and that the elements of of Iraqi society that I encounter each time differ quite widely from what I encountered the time before. I was last in Iraq in February 2008, and I was really, as I said, in a different Iraq. I was in a different Iraq because although we had reached the quantitative limit of our surge forces, there were still major tasks that remained in order to secure Iraq from the existing violence problems and existing political problems, namely a large presence of al-Qaeda in Iraq in Mosul and a serious presence of militias in Sadr City in Basra. And so when I returned this time and was able to walk through Mosul and indeed walk through Basra without wearing a helmet, I was really quite struck by the difference in the level of security. But what struck me even more was the difference in the political environment in Iraq. And I really want to stress that although many folks here believe and state as a truism that although the surge has improved security in Iraq, it has not improved the political situation, it has not generated political progress, I think that truism is false. There is a great deal of political change underway in Iraq right now, and it may lag behind the security, but it is really quite exciting and really should be the premise of our discussion about what our future U.S. presence should be in Iraq. Because right now, the future of Iraq, whether in fact Iraq is able to be able to fulfill its, whether we, the United States, are able to fulfill our objectives in Iraq, rests not really on what the Iraqis do, but mostly on what we, the United States, do. We have the following objectives in Iraq. We wish to create a stable and secure Iraq that has a legitimate government elected by its people, at peace with its neighbors, an ally of the United States in the war on terror, and that is what we are seeking. That is why the United States is there. And those are interests that I believe we all share, that we would like Iraq to be that way. What I can tell you right now is that Iraq has the opportunity to be that way. An ally of ours in the war on terror, at peace with a legitimate democratically elected government, at peace with its neighbors. And the way in which we, the United States, and the government of Iraq can achieve those objectives is by pursuing a moderate policy, a careful policy, and a cautious policy regarding our military presence and the drawdown of troops within Iraq. Right now, our troops in Iraq are securing the center of the country and assisting the Iraqi security forces in securing Mosul, Basra, and other peripheral but nevertheless important areas. And in doing so, they are allowing the government of Iraq to focus on new tasks, particularly governing. The passage of the benchmark laws that Congress had determined would be the main indicator of political progress, but also preparing themselves for the next set of democratic elections, the provincial elections that will be held most likely in December or January of this year. What we do between now and January matters immensely to the outcome of these elections and to the ability of the government actually to achieve a stable state. What we need to do is retain enough troop presence in order to secure the elections and make sure that they are free and fair, to see to it that there are no particular malign influences on the election, and also to see to it that the enemy groups that are now in retreat because of the large operations in Mosul and Basra do not actually return in sufficient number and with sufficient capability to affect the security and stability of the government of Iraq. We have an opportunity. We've reached a lull in violence because of our success. But I think, as all of you know, war is not a linear and predictable activity. there is no glide path from here to a stable and secure Iraq. Rather, we have a series of tasks that we must achieve. The first being securing elections, the second being preventing the return of enemy groups, the third being setting the conditions for a long-term strategic relationship between the United States and Iraq, a relationship that the Iraqis actually seek, and that is very much in the interests of the United States. Fourthly, to see to it that the new and emerging political order within Iraq emerges without actual violent conflict, that once we get through the elections period, we actually have the ability for the political parties to continue to resolve their disputes through debate rather than through violence. And we do this by seeing to it that we retain a peacekeeping presence in Iraq, because that's really what we're on the road to. That is a positive outcome, and it's one that we shape, and we shape by our presence on the ground. We have a negative outcome as well that we can generate, and we generate by pulling out too soon, because there are still enemies on the ground in Iraq. I've seen them. I've met them in person sometimes. They're interesting folks. And I've seen where they are, what they're doing, and what their intentions are. We have Iranian-backed special groups which do intend to return to Baghdad and create a great deal of violence in the September, October, November period in the lead-up to our elections and the lead-up to Iraq's elections. They are on their way back, and we, not the Iraqi army, are actually most capable of handling the kind of sophisticated targeting of these special group elements that are likely to return. Likewise, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, though gravely hurt, is not yet defeated. Its will is not yet broken. And although we see a temporary lull once again in its ability to wage spectacular attacks, we also see that it's likely to return. And I cannot stress enough that the enemies of Iraq, whether they are Al-Qaeda, whether they are Sunni extremists, or whether they are Shia extremists backed by Iran or simply functioning as lawless militias, are there. They are there. And the extraordinary thing right now is that they are quiet, and they are quieted by the success of the Iraqi security forces in defeating those armed groups side by side, partnered with U.S. forces. The vibrant Iraqi political life that we now see is controversial, rambunctious, and not moving slowly or swiftly. But it is nevertheless moving. We have seen the creation of new parties, the Sawa al-Iraq, the Awakening Party, which is rivaling and challenging the established Sunni parties in the upcoming provincial elections. And the tensions right now between the Sawa and the IIP are really quite strong and quite high, and likely to remain high through the elections period. Likewise, we see a great political struggle between Prime Minister Maliki and the ISKI party for preeminence and control within the South. We see a great fracturing of the Sadrist trend and its associated political movements, a division of the Sadrist parliamentarians from their military forces, and a great opportunity on the one hand for those parliamentarians to re-enter political life without their militia, but also the possibility of a fractious and unseemly regrouping of those parliamentarians who are now running as independent candidates in the upcoming elections. Indeed, there are 502 political parties registered for the upcoming provincial elections, a sign of the range of diversity of Iraq's political landscape. And although I think in the past we have always looked to elections as the culmination of our military operations, it would be much wiser if we adopted a much more practical attitude and saw the upcoming provincial elections not only as a result of the surge, the greater security, the rise of new political entities, and the agreement by extremist groups to enter into political debate and discussion rather than retain their violent means of solving conflict, but also is the beginning of Iraq's new political process, one that will need assistance in order to make sure that the outcomes that emerge do not result in a retrenchment to the kinds of civil conflict we saw in 2006, or in a new version of that civil conflict that emerges after the dissolution and reconstitution of JAM, the dissolution of Sunni extremist groups, and the perhaps failed expectations of the populace because of the government's inability to meet their needs in a most timely fashion. We who study counterinsurgency realize that our forces that are down on the ground engage there on the ground not simply in order to provide security, but also to provide economic, social, and political assistance to the provinces and to the central government of Iraq. And that really creating an environment in Iraq that is secure and is stable requires the presence of U.S. forces to fill in as the government of Iraq increasingly steps up, as it has over the past year. It has by providing ISERP, Iraqi SERP, funds for emergency assistance to our and their troops in order to engage in reconstruction projects. It has stepped up by providing a good deal of legislation that, in fact, has made it possible for the reintegration of Sunni and Shia extremists into government. And finally, the government of Iraq has stepped up by engaging in some of the negotiations that will lay the basis for the future political discourse within Iraq. We as the United States have a choice right now. We can see through this process of elections and see to it that they are secure and that the situation after the elections does not revert to violence. We have that choice. We make that happen. We also have another choice, which is to reduce our forces very quickly, to give a timetable to our enemy, to let the enemies know exactly when they can regroup, exactly when they should regroup, exactly when we're leaving, and to show that we are not, in fact, committed to the Iraqi political, social, or military process of development. What happens next in Iraq, as I said, does not really rest on the Iraqis. They're moving along in a dynamic political process that we are really ancillary to at this point, but we provide the security necessary for that process to continue. What happens in Iraq next depends on us and whether or not we will see to it that this potential for a moderate democratic outcome actually reaches its fruition in the spring, at which point it is most certainly possible to begin drawing down our forces, or whether we decide at this point or that point to reduce our forces precipitously, creating an impetus for conflict among Iraq's political parties as they look to secure themselves against internal enemies that are likely to rise up again and gain vis-a-vis one another in a violent political way. I think that the choice is obvious. A free, stable, democratic Iraq at peace with its neighbors, an ally in the war on terror that is within reach. That is what we have created. That is what we have created with the surge. Let's not, by our own actions, fail to achieve those goals.
Thank you, Kim. Charles?
Good morning. Now, as they said, used to say on Monty Python, now for something completely different. I want to thank our hosts at the USIP for their invitation to participate in this panel. We are obviously at a point of transition, both in our own government and in our policies in Iraq. So this is a this is an important moment to focus in on these issues. I am one of the organizers of the Task Force for a Responsible Withdrawal from Iraq, where we have published a set of 25 initiatives that complement and support a short timeline military withdrawal. They involve very considerable engagement, some of it extending years into the future. This is engagement with Iraq and with the region. This is the short report we did summarizing the initiatives. Please take a copy. There's some outside. And please read it. It's quite short, hopefully quite digestible. So get the troops out very soon and remain responsibly engaged in Iraq and the region. I would disengage from the failed policies of the past, policies based on strategic error that have led us into a strategic disaster. Military occupation of Iraq is the central feature of this strategic error. With a new administration soon in the White House, it is time to come to our senses, stop digging, and climb out of the hole. No amount of clever adjustment at the tactical and operational levels will get us where we need to be. Our only strategic change can get us on the road to recovery. Three fundamental strategic errors have been made. First, we miscalculated what might be accomplished by force of arms. We failed to appreciate the limits on the utility of military power. Second, we failed to appreciate the power and dynamics of identity politics and the likely reaction to foreign occupation. Third, we failed to take seriously the importance of international cooperation and legitimacy in the eyes of the world. The price we and others are paying for these blunders is not measured in blood and treasure alone, although these costs are already terribly high. One example of these extraordinary costs that we address in the task force report, there are now millions of refugees and millions of internally displaced persons, totaling 15% of the Iraqi population. Consider that the displacement of a proportional number of Americans would mean 45 million Americans forced from their homes, the equivalent of emptying out the population of America's 10 largest cities. This happened under American watch in Iraq. It is an immense failure for an occupying power, one we still respond to in the most careless of ways. In addition, we have weakened and misdirected our security assets. Since 2004, the Army has been at an unsustainable op tempo with accumulating harm to that service. We have severely damaged the reputation of the U.S., especially in the Muslim world. We have damaged our alliances. We have created a catalyst for communal conflict and provided a recruiting gift to Iraqi extremists. We have provided a motivator for jihadism and for terrorist tactics worldwide. We have handed Iran strategic and economic benefits which accrue every day we keep our troops in Iraq. We have tarnished the meaning and promise of democracy and undermined our efforts to promote it. A new basis for U.S. policy and engagement. Moving from the level of strategy to consider U.S. operational policy in Iraq, it becomes clear that we must proceed on an entirely new basis, one that puts the Iraqis at the center and that gathers the international community to our side as co-equal partners in supporting reconciliation and recovery for this traumatized society. The new basis necessarily begins with setting a credible, meaning short, timeline for withdrawal. This is because withdrawal is essential to drawing the remaining rejectionists, Sunni and Shia alike, into the political process. Withdrawal is essential to further reducing the appeal of Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. Withdrawal is essential to restoring the credibility of the Iraqi government as sovereign and as a leader of an inclusion and reconciliation process. Withdrawal is essential to unblocking international cooperation, especially of the key contact states, who can do much more to help stabilize Iraq. Now, only some of the benefits of setting a credible withdrawal timeline will materialize simply by announcing the withdrawal. In addition, it will take effective diplomacy and considerable resources before and after to draw the rejectionists in and to catalyze international cooperation and support. This is much of what we have attempted to specify in the task force report. A new realism. The new basis of policy implies a new realism about what we can hope to accomplish in Iraq and how. It means finally coming to terms with a number of uncomfortable facts. American military presence and action has been part of the problem. It is an affront to Iraqi national communal identities and a stimulant to rejectionism and insurgency and violence. From the start, we have been handicapped by being an alien power. It means we are judged by a different standard, and it tars everyone who works with us. It makes suspect every process we presume to lead. Our moral authority and our ability to truly win hearts and minds in sufficient numbers has been undercut by too much firepower and too many house raids, checkpoint killings, road rams, jailings, and abuses of power. Yes, others may have done worse, maybe much worse, but we are judged differently because we are alien to that society. Our authority is also undercut because we wear our privilege and self-interest on our sleeves. It is evident in our insistence of immunity for our nationals and in the details of basing agreements and oil deals we try to cut. So we shouldn't be surprised when opinion polls find that very few Iraqis think the U.S. is doing a good job in their country. Nor should we be surprised when focus groups conducted by our military find, as the Washington Post reported last fall, that Iraqis of all sectarian and ethnic groups believe that the U.S. military invasion is the primary root of the violent differences among them and see departure of occupying forces as the key to national reconciliation. Sentiments like this no doubt contribute to Maliki's pushback on basing agreements and to support of a withdrawal timeline. A final element of requisite realism has to do with the goal of producing a reliable, stable, secure, well-governed, and prosperous Iraq. This is the work of decades, not years. It is principally a political job, and it is principally the job of Iraqis, although they will need substantial international support. So what kind of international support? Support dominated by the U.S. gets in the way of progress for the reasons I said earlier. So any strategy that involves staying militarily is at odds with putative U.S. goals for Iraqi society. Beyond the surge has brought down the level of violence, right? Yes, and today the level of violence is comparable proportionally to the worst years of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. It is a very good thing that fewer are dying in Iraq. But the improvement alone is far from sufficient evidence from which to conclude that our policy is now on the right track. I'm sure we'll discuss in Q&A more about the surge strategy. I think it is important to note some of its limits. The surge has reduced violence by leveraging and reinforcing the intercommunal and intra-communal divisions that plague Iraq. Think of the walls that the American soldiers have built to separate Sunni and Shia enclaves in Baghdad. And the fact remains that none of the powerful Iraqi groups or leaders with whom we are currently allied share the American vision or purpose, not even the Kurds. Our alliances are marriages of convenience, and pretty shaky ones at that. Indeed, the surge marks the limit of what the United States might accomplish in Iraq by military means. Now we need to bring into the political process most of the remaining rejectionists and to catalyze the type of international support that will facilitate this inclusion and national accord. And this requires a military withdrawal. Now, before I close, I want to just mention a couple of the most important complements to this withdrawal. First, the U.S. should call for the establishment of an international support group comprising the five permanent Security Council members, Iraq's six neighbors, and a representative of the U.N. Secretary General. Within this support group, the U.S. should seek an agreement on a code of conduct for international relations with Iraq, emphasizing the principle of non-interference, an agreement on common goals and compromises required for the stabilization of Iraq, and a collaborative support for reinvigorated Iraqi inclusion and reconciliation process. As vital background to this, the U.S. must reengage Syria and Iran in non-coercive give-and-take diplomacy addressing bilateral issues. Proceeding on a basis of mutual respect, this diplomacy should have wide-ranging scope, thereby affording the United States leverage in the talks about mutual benefits of principled non-interference in Iraq. Obviously, there is no basis for these discussions unless the U.S. is ready to pledge and demonstrate non-interference as well. This requires a short timeline for withdrawal. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. Colin?
Hi, folks, give me 1 second here with the technology. I worked at DOD for about a year and a half, which means I'm now constitutionally incapable of doing anything that doesn't involve PowerPoint in some way. I feel like if I do it that way, somebody will come and take away my badge.
PowerPoint corrupts absolutely.
I think that's fair. All right, great. So I'm going to talk to you about a policy that we at the Center for New American Security call conditional engagement. Much of what I'm talking about today is rooted in a report that I wrote along with Michelle Flournoy, who's the president of our organization, and Sean Brimley, who's written previous reports on Iraq for CNAS. And copies of the report are available out on the table, so I encourage you all to grab a copy if you find anything that I say interesting, or perhaps if you find things that I say confusing and need further clarification. I kind of see myself as in the Goldilocks position here on the panel, in which I kind of feel like Kim's policy is too hot, Charles is way too cold, and hopefully I'll convince you that mine is just right. I think that any evaluation of Iraq has to actually start with our national interest, but I wouldn't frame it quite in the way that Kim did, because when Kim talked about our national interest, she framed it largely in terms of a set of objectives that we maximally would desire inside Iraq. I actually think that our tendency to talk about national interest in Iraq is plagued by two different types of problems, Iraq centrism and Iraq maximalism. Iraq centrism in the sense that we don't often enough situate Iraq within a broader constellation of our regional and global interests. Iraq maximalism in the sense that we tend to outline a set of ideal outcomes in Iraq that may not be achievable at acceptable cost. So I'm going to try to navigate between those and avoid those two pitfalls. We argue that Iraq intersects with three different types of national interests that the United States has. The interest in combating terrorism, the interest in preserving regional stability in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf specifically, and maintaining U.S. leadership. And we basically argue that set of interests generates objectives inside Iraq and outside Iraq, and there's some tension between these two. So, for example, the United States does have an interest in preventing Iraq from becoming the equivalent of Afghanistan on September 10th of 2001, much as Kim suggests. But on the other hand, we have an interest in our long-term presence in Iraq not being a propaganda device and a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda worldwide, and an interest in an enduring presence in Iraq not detracting from our efforts in Afghanistan. So if the goal is combating terrorism, you have to balance the need to avoid a failed state in Iraq, to avoid a safe haven for al-Qaeda in Iraq, and avoid a strategic overcommitment to Iraq that is counterproductive to the war on terrorism around the world. Similarly, for regional stability, we need to avoid a failed state in Iraq because we don't want the neighbors to intervene or for Iraq's instability to cascade outwards. But our presence in Iraq is also destabilizing to the region, and in particular reduces our deterrent and coercive powers vis-a-vis Iran. I think probably the largest victor of the toppling of Saddam Hussein's regime was Iran. I also think the longer that we stay in Iraq, the more likely that Iraq's Sunni Arab neighbors basically fall prey to a broad free-riding problem whereby they don't step up to counterbalance Iranian influence in Iraq. Now, of course, we have an interest in not leaving Iraq a failed state as it relates to preventing Iranian hegemony. But the good news on that score is that Iraqi nationalism probably blocks all-out Iranian hegemony as long as Iraq is not left a failed state. Lastly, we have an interest in maintaining our leadership. The war has been disastrous to both our hard and our soft power. It's difficult to make an argument that the war has made us safer, or at least that the benefits have outweighed the costs. At the same time, we don't want to leave Iraq in such a way that it also devastates our credibility around the world. So the bottom line is we need to craft a strategy that avoids a failed state in Iraq, which I believe Charles's strategy would produce, or perpetuates strategic overcommitment in Iraq, which I feel basically Kim's strategy would do, and instead embraces a more realistic, pragmatic objective in Iraq, which is sustainable stability. That is, a degree of stability in Iraq that is sustainable as American forces withdraw and eventually completely leave the country. Has there been any progress towards sustainable stability? Here, I think Kim has argued that there's been a considerable amount of progress. I would be a little more glass half empty than Kim's view, which I think is a little glass overflowing, actually. There has been significant security gains. There's no doubt about that. All right, attacks are down to early 2004 levels. Civilian casualties are down to pre-Samara levels. These are significant benefits. Tens of thousands of Iraqis are alive today that would not have been alive had the violence continued at the level that it was at late 2006. There are basically four reasons why the violence came down. One was more of us doing better counterinsurgency practices. The second was the Sunni awakening, which started in Anbar before the surge and then accelerated and spread out outwards from Anbar in the summer of 2007, principally in Baghdad. There have been some politicians asserting that the surge produced the Anbar awakening. That's only true in a world in which time moves in the wrong direction. But the surge did play a role, and especially the strategy related to the surge played a role in expanding the awakening outwards from Anbar and consolidating success. But it was the strategy, I would argue, rather than the troops per se. Obviously, Muqtada al-Sadr's decision to stand down the Jaish al-Mahdi's armed activities in August played a key role. Our commanders have admitted as such. And last but not least, sadly, the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad and the construction of defensible enclaves, in large part through the role of American use of concrete in Baghdad, has separated the parties in such a way that the violence has come down. The political gains have not matched the security gains, and here, very quickly, there is some good news here. There's been a lot of Sunni accommodation with us, less with the government of Iraq. There's been increased revenue sharing with Iraqi provinces. There have been some laws passed, including tobaccification, amnesty, and provincial powers legislation, and there's been some symbolic outreach between the government, the Shia-dominated government, and its rivals. The bad news is that the Maliki government and its ministries remain corrupt and prone to sectarian bias. The implementation of de-ba'athification, amnesty, and the provincial powers law have been complicated, most notably this week with the passage and then vetoing of the provincial elections law. And many of the underlying ethno-sectarian conflicts have simply not been resolved. I think it's really important in this kind of silly season of trying to score points on things like political benchmarks and other things, that passing a law with the name of the benchmark is not the same thing as accomplishing the objective of the benchmark. All right. There's an argument that the de-bathification law, for example, could complicate probably the single most important thing for political accommodation moving forward, which is integration of the Sons of Iraq into the Iraqi security forces, as an example. What are some requirements moving forward for sustainable stability? In terms of political accommodation, I think it's clear that the Sons of Iraq, which now number about 100,000, need to be integrated or otherwise fully employed. The Maliki government has been very slow in that regard. It's important to co-opt moderate elements of the Sadr's trend, and there I think making sure that elections get conducted peacefully and fairly are particularly important, as well as continuing to peel off and target more extremist elements of the Jaish al-Mahdi. It's important, and it remains important, to pass an oil law and to settle territorial disputes, principally in Kirkuk. The provincial elections law being going down to the veto is principally about Kirkuk, and we can talk about that in the Q&A if you're interested. There's also a need for improved governance, including fairly implementing both provincial and national elections. And here I'm actually quite concerned. I think a lot of the efforts that the Maliki government is engaged in the Shia South, in Basra and Maysan province, for example, were good things in the sense of returning law and order. But they were also shaping operations for Dawa and Iski in the provincial elections. And we need an Iraqi government that prevents militias from intimidating voters, but also doesn't use the ISF to intimidate voters. Because the only way to actually bring the extremists into the political process or peel them away from the mass of their movement is through fair elections. We also need to resettle refugees and internally displaced people. The Iraqi government needs to do a much better job of providing equitable essential services. And over the long run, the United States needs to continue to professionalize the Iraqi security forces and, in particular, make sure that the Iraqi army becomes a true neutral guardian of the state. There are a number of strategic options, and I'm not going to go through them. This is one way to talk about them. But basically, you have the basis for U.S. military engagement in Iraq, whether you set a trajectory for the stay or departure based on a bilateral agreement or a unilateral timetable. And then there's the degree of U.S. commitment to the Iraqi government and whether it has low conditionality or high conditionality. I would argue that Kim's position basically falls here in the unconditional engagement section.
I disagree.
Okay. She can disagree. Let me put it this way. The reason why it's low conditionality and not no conditionality is that we do actually condition our support to the Iraqi government at the tactical level. But I highly recommend that you read Linda Robinson's forthcoming book, Tell Me How This Ends, when it comes out in September, because she documents repeatedly about how the efforts by our diplomats and commanders to use tactical conditionality to put pressure on the Maliki government has been repeatedly undermined by the unwillingness of the White House to make our relationship, our strategic relationship in Iraq, and particularly our support with the Iraqi security forces, conditional on the Iraqis actually moving towards political accommodation and more respect for the rule of law. And her judgments from there are based on the complaints from our diplomats and our military commanders. I think the major problem with unconditional engagement is that it assumes that the major challenge in Iraq is one of capacity, not of political will. That all we need to do is buy time and the Iraqis will eventually sort things out, or build capacity and the Iraqis will eventually be able to govern. But if the problem is a deeper problem than that, and one associated with political will, then we need to figure out a way to twist arms, right? And we shouldn't be giving up the stick of withdrawing our support by unconditionally embracing the government. A good example of this is, you probably all know, George Bush talks on VTC with Maliki almost every week. And I've never been in one of those meetings, but the folks that I know have suggest that they're basically a kind of, you're doing a hell of a job, brownie, type of pat on the back, attaboy type of arguments, which is not conducive to pushing the Iraqis to make tough decisions. It also perpetuates strategic overcommitment, which I talked about before. The unilateral timetable that for a total withdrawal, quickly, safely, et cetera, also is problematic, not only because largely it risks uncorking all of the problems that the surge and the various other dynamics have done a good job in tamping down. So it risks a failed state in Iraq. All right, you'll never be able to read this, but it's in the report. The policy that we advocate is called conditional engagement. It has a number of elements to it. The first thing to recognize is that I think most Iraqi leaders in the current ruling coalition, right, want the United States to draw down. That's why you're seeing talk during the SOFA and the SFA negotiations about a time horizon or a departure or a transition from the United States outside of Iraqi cities, drawing down its forces and switching its role. On the other hand, I think most Iraqi leaders also want residual support from the United States, including residual military support. All right? This is what the U.S. military calls overwatch. Right? Most Iraqi leaders want some degree of overwatch during a transitional period. But what most Iraqi leaders also don't want is a permanent U.S. military presence in Iraq, with the sole exception I would put here of the Kurds, who would be happy to have a small base or two up in Iraq, the Kurdish territories in Iraq forever, I think. If you start from that assumption, conditional engagement says you need to do a couple things. The first thing that you do is you need to negotiate, all right, a time horizon or a timeline for the step down of U.S. forces towards this overwatch position. All right? But the key point, the conditional part of conditional engagement, comes at what you condition the residual support on. All right? If you look back at the November 2007 Declaration of Principles signed by Maliki and Bush, you will see that the Iraqi government wants a lot of things from the United States. It wants the United States to continue to conduct counterterrorism operations. It wants continued training, equipping, support, and the provision of critical enablers like intelligence, air and fire support, medevac, logistics, et cetera, for the Iraqi security forces. It wants some transitional presence to deter Iraq's neighbors from invading Iraq until Iraq's armed forces are capable of protecting their own borders. It wants continued economic support. It wants continued diplomatic support. I'm happy that the Iraqi leadership wants all these things. It shouldn't come for free. All right. The fundamental flaw of our strategy has been political, and it's been the absence of having strategic conditionality. The residual support that is negotiated as part of this process has to be conditional on the Iraqi security forces not being used as tools of sectarian warfare, not being used to rig elections, integrating the Sons of Iraq, and taking the other steps that I identified earlier to move Iraq towards sustainable stability. And if the Iraqi government is not willing to do that, then we need to consider other options. And maybe under those circumstances, things along the lines that Charles proposes are a good idea. But I would keep those as plan B, not as plan A. The last thing about regional diplomacy, I actually think that a policy of conditional engagement should be embedded within a broader regional framework that is much along the lines of what Charles talked about, including all of the neighbors, although Charles, I think all of the individuals that you indicated we should include in these talks are already ongoing, and we already have contacts with them in broadly within the framework that you say, with the exclusion of high-level contacts with the Syrians and the Iranians, which I would also advocate us doing. So I think there obviously is a regional diplomacy piece of this, and I'm happy to talk in the Q&A about how conditional engagement might help foster some of those bargains, in particular with Iran. But with that, I will hand the floor over to Rand.
Thank you very much, Colin. Rand?
Thank you very much, Dan. Glad to be here. First of all, if Colin was Goldilocks, I don't know what that makes me, but I'm going to try and give you the sort of scene from the Iraqi side, what it looks like from Baghdad, and try sort of to work from the inside out. But I do find myself, I should tell you, that I am in great agreement with what Colin said. And that I find that his the way he looks at this and the way he sees us going forward is, in fact, a very sound way. It's a middle-of-the-road position, but it's also based on a very good understanding of the facts on the ground. So, first of all, the first thing I want to say is that the U.S. military presence is not just there for military purposes. The U.S. military presence does have political implications as well. And to make this quite obvious, all you have to think about is the way that the U.S. military actually engaged with the Sahwas. The Sahwas certainly started in the summer of 2006. But I can tell you that by September, October of 2006, when I spoke to Iraqi leaders and said, what are you going to do with these Sahwa movements? I mean, this is a great opportunity. And their answer was, you know, we don't need to do anything with them. What they have to do is come to us and say, please, bring us into the government, help us out. We are not going to go to them and try to pull them in. What happened was when the U.S. military, when the surge happened, and even before the surge, in fact, the U.S. military recognized this extraordinary opportunity and capitalized on it and revamped the Sahwa, paid them, put them together. And then, on a diplomatic level, more or less twisted the arm of the Iraqi government to negotiate with the Sahwas and to actually bring them into the fold and to recognize them politically. And that is a role that the U.S. military played. So from that perspective, the U.S. military has had an extremely important political role. So we should not, we should keep that in mind, that there is a political aspect to U.S. military presence. Inside Iraq, there's no doubt that the U.S. military is an irritant to national sensibilities, that the Iraqis want to see the last foreign soldier off Iraqi soil. On the other hand, there's also a recognition that Iraq is still a very fragile, very vulnerable state, that we still live in a state of uncertainty, political and military uncertainty, and that the U.S. presence, military presence, is important for the time being. And the Iraqis, both the leadership and the population, are torn in this dilemma of, in a sense, dependence of on U.S. presence and yet a desire to see the U.S. leave. What is very interesting is that up until about 2007, the Sunni insurgency, essentially, and the Sadris were the ones who were claiming the sort of mantle of nationalism, wanting the U.S. to leave and fighting United States troops. You see a reversal today in that position. Today, it is the Shia political parties who want the U.S. to move and to leave, and the U.S. and the Sunnis, and even the Sadris, who feel vulnerable, who feel exposed, and therefore want the U.S. to stay. And this reversal of position really happened round about 2007, and I saw it happening throughout the year last year, and you hear that now as I go back and forth to Baghdad. This is what I hear all the time. Needless to say, had the U.S. Had a good strategy and worked sensibly in Iraq over the past 5 years, we would not be finding ourselves in this dilemma. But I do agree with Colin that it was a failure of policy, a failure of strategy, and a failure of tactic that brought us to this impasse where we want to leave, the Iraqis want us to leave, and yet it is very difficult to withdraw completely. One of the indicators of this failure is that, indeed, although the Iraqi government does things that we do not like, and it may well be that in private conversations, the ambassador or even the president may say to Maliki that we don't agree with this and we don't approve of that, but there has rarely been a declaratory statement by the U.S. government, either the representatives in Baghdad and the embassy or here in Washington, sanctioning the Maliki government, saying that the Iraqi government has not achieved this, has not done that, that we are not in favor of those policies or that we are disappointed. It is very, very rare, if at all, that we hear any kind of sanctioning. And therefore, everybody basks in this sort of love-in that has been going on, and that is neither useful for Iraq nor useful for the United States. Another problem that we have had is the way that the U.S. has approached the building of the Iraqi army, in which, again, we, as we have done in many cases, we have reversed the proper order of the building the army, and we have concentrated first on quantity rather than quality. Way back in 2004, I heard all the time people in the Pentagon saying, we have trained 300,000, we have trained 400,000. What did that exactly mean? So we concentrated on quantity and not quality. We concentrated on training for combat. But we forgot about command and control issues and chain of command issues, and that came much later. Then we have ignored the issue of the integration of the Iraqi army into one integrated unit rather than a factionalized collection of groups who really owed allegiance more to their sect or to political parties rather than to the state. And finally, we have completely ignored the issue of the loyalty of the army to the state, which Colin referred to. And this is a major structural defect in what we would like to see as sustainable security and sustainable stability in Iraq. The army has to be constructed on a different basis in order for us to have that sustainability, which we don't have now. I want to briefly talk about the SOFA and the negotiations for a bilateral agreement. It is quite true that the Iraqis do want a bilateral agreement. And one of the reasons is what Colin referred to, that the Iraqi government and all the Iraqi political parties are very aware of the vulnerability of Iraq, that this is really still, in many senses, a young state, not a young nation, but a young state. The institutions of the state are still very fragile, still very unformed, and the vulnerability to Iranian influence, to Turkey, to Saudi interference, and so on and so forth, is very present in everybody's mind. And as a state that is still in formation, the question is, whom do we want to ally with? Do we want to ally with Iran? And the answer by most people is not really. Who are our allies? Turkey, well, there are problems there, Saudi Arabia, and so on. And really the best ally is seen, the strategic ally, is seen as the United States. The question is the modalities of this future alliance. And I think this is where there has been a tremendous failure of diplomacy on the side of both the U.S. and the Iraqis. First of all, the timing was all wrong. Trying to do this in a year, in an election year in the U.S. and an election year in Iraq was, I can't imagine who thought about that. These are sensitive issues, both in the U.S. The U.S. wants to understand what are the ramifications of a SOFA, Status of Forces Agreement, for its own troops in Iraq. Are they subject to Iraqi courts? What about the protections for independent contractors? There's a whole range of issues that simply cannot be discussed in Washington in any sane and cool manner and are bound to be politicized. We have elections in Iraq, and Prime Minister Maliki has provincial elections that are extremely important because they're going to set the stage for next year's national elections. He can't afford to appear soft. Maliki is triumphant right now over what are perceived as the government's successes in Basra and Sadr City and Amara and so on. And so he wants to build up on that sort of nationalist image. He has downsized the Sadris considerably, and he now wants to wear the Sadrist nationalist mantle. He can't take it off. The elections require ultra-nationalist rhetoric. And yet, in this charged environment, we were trying to negotiate a SOFA. This was unthinkable. The other problem strategically with the framing of the SOFA is that it was framed as the conditions for U.S. troops remaining in Iraq, the conditions for their staying in Iraq. And it should have been framed as the conditions for their withdrawal from Iraq. Had it been framed in that context, I think it would have been a much easier sell, both in the United States and in Iraq. So there were certainly problems, and I think what is being discussed now, as far as I understand, is either a much simpler agreement that doesn't have to go to the Iraqi parliament and doesn't go to the U.S. Congress in these difficult times of elections in both countries. I'm not sure how likely that is. I think the other option that is being discussed is continuing the U.N. resolution, extending the U.N. resolution under which the U.S. forces, the multinational forces, operate. But again, we have a political issue here because Maliki, the prime minister, has said, we need to take Iraq from under Chapter 7 of the U.N. Charter, which makes it mandatory for the Iraqi government to accept foreign troops and puts Iraq under all sorts of constraints. So he sold the idea to the Iraqi public that we must get out of, from under Chapter 7. And so now we're looking at the option of almost an identical UN resolution, but under Chapter 6 of the UN Charter, which says that this will be done with the agreement of the Iraqi government. In other words, the Iraqi government becomes a signatory to this agreement, and therefore it's a cooperative agreement. These are the options that are being discussed at the moment, and they're talking about perhaps a 6-month or a 12-month, so that in 2009, certainly after the U.S. elections, we can talk about a bilateral agreement in a much cooler environment, although there will still be elections in Iraq, and that will complicate issues. But in terms of U.S. continuing presence in Iraq, and I want to argue for the issue of conditionality. I think it is very dangerous to do an unconditional withdrawal, as Charles was suggesting, and I will talk a little bit about why I think that. And at the same time, I think that going with Kim's suggestion that all's well and all we need to do is continue as we were, I think that is all. That is also dangerous. All is not well in Iraq. Yes, the security situation is better. Yes, like Kim, I have been able to go and walk around everywhere in Iraq, and I get people from outside Baghdad who tell me about the situation, and yet there is a great sense of apprehension that this improvement is impermanent. There's a sense of this could break down any moment. And the reason it could break down, the reasons, is because, remember, the surge was conducted. Not only it was conducted to bring down the level of violence in order to allow political reconciliation to take place in Iraq. We should never lose sight of that fact, of the surge. And the question is, the surge has succeeded in reducing the violence and providing greater security, but has there been a political process that could make this permanent, that could underpin the security that we have gained? And I believe not. It's not a zero. We haven't not done anything on the political level, but that the gains on the political level have been really very small in comparison to what is needed in order to have sustainable, and I insist on the word of sustainable security, sustainable stability. First of all, I talked about the army. I would say that the army is still fragmented, does not necessarily owe loyalty to the state, but there have been units of militias, for example, from ISKI, the Supreme Council, units from the Sahwas have moved in. They have moved in as units, and their chain of command, who do they report to, is still somewhat questionable. The army, of course, is much better than the police, as we know, and we're told over and over again. The police is still in a very bad shape in terms of the factionalization and the political, owing political allegiance to particular parties. But the sectarianism, the factionalism exists within the army, and we're still not at the point where the army is a national institution. And until that happens, we can't have sustainable security. Similarly, on the issue of reconciliation, the constitutional review that happened last summer was presented to Parliament. It was presented a year ago. And there have been two problems with it. There were several major issues that the review committee did not even address because they were hot political items that they could not resolve in committee, and they decided not to even deal with that. But even the recommendations they made have not been looked into by Parliament. For an entire year, Parliament has not looked at the modest recommendations that were made by the committee. We still have a big problem with the Constitution. We still have a problem with amnesty, although there is an amnesty law. But as Colin said, creating a law does not mean achieving the results that you want with this law. The amnesty law is still very deficient, has not been implemented properly. Even more seriously, the de-Ba'athification law has not been implemented adequately. In addition to that, the awakenings. There was talk about taking in 20% of the Sunnis who were involved in the awakenings and the Sons of Iraq and so on, all those Sunni groups in Anbar, and by the way, in other areas, in other predominantly Sunni areas of Iraq, there was a pledge to take in 20% of them into the army and into the police. We have not reached the threshold of 20%, and nobody has told us what is going to be done with the remaining 80%. If these people don't feel that they are equal partners in the state, if they don't feel that as Iraqi citizens they have equal rights to all other Iraqi citizens, then we are going to have a problem, and we could have a relapse into an insurgency mode by those Sunni groups. If they say to them, what have we got for having fought Al-Qaeda? What have we got for having had our sons and our fathers killed by Al-Qaeda because our decision to side with the state? If they don't see any benefits to that, if they don't feel integrated into the nation, into the state, they're going to relapse. We have a serious problem of displaced persons and refugees. And that is not just an issue of, not just a humanitarian issue, it's a political issue. The demographics of Baghdad have changed. I would even argue that the demographics of Iraq as a whole have changed. We have had a serious loss of Sunnis in Iraq. Most of the people who are in Jordan and in Syria today are Sunnis. And in electoral districts like Baghdad and like Diyala and so on, the change demographics are going to influence not only the provincial elections, but ultimately the national elections. We have a very weak judiciary that is not independent. And again, issues of rule of law, until people feel that there is rule of law, that there is due process, that there are courts that they can have recourse to, nobody is going to feel comfortable with this new state. And finally, we have the elections. Colin referred to the very appropriate and necessary activities in Basra, particularly in order to combat the militias. But I don't think this was done totally disinterestedly. There are elections coming up. There is a byproduct of the pacification of Basra and, say, Sadr City and Amara, particularly Nasriya, because the elections are going to depend on power, money, access to weapons. And there is a great danger that the election season that's going to extend throughout 2009 is going to be destabilizing. Okay. So I know my time is probably up, but I think that the issue of withdrawal of forces certainly ought to happen. Certainly the U.S. should negotiate with the Iraqi government on a time frame, and I don't know what horizon means. I would call it a time frame. In other words, rather than saying on October 10th, 2009, we're going to withdraw X, we should have a certain time limitations and time markers, but they must be tied to achievements in Iraq that could ensure sustainability for when we withdraw our troops. That should be the guiding principle, sustainability. Now, a lot of people will say the U.S. has absolutely no leverage. What are we going to do? We ask them to provide these laws, these benchmarks, and so on. And, well, they've passed the laws, some laws, but they haven't been implemented properly. Some laws they haven't passed. The U.S. is powerless. Well, I'm sorry to say, I think that is not the case. I do not think that we have used the whole range of carrots and sticks over the last 5 years that were available to the United States. Indeed, Iraq wants a lot from the U.S. Quite apart from the military, it wants diplomatic support. Remember, it was thanks to U.S. pressure that the Paris Club in 2004 or 2005 agreed to an 80% reduction of Iraq's debt. It was thanks also to U.S. cajoling and pressure that the UAE cancelled its debts, that the Saudi Arabians are going to reduce their debts. The U.S. has done a great deal for this nascent Iraqi state, and the Iraqi leaders recognize that they will continue to need economic support, diplomatic support, let alone military support. We have not done a good job of looking at tools by which to entice, cajole, dangle carrots, and at the same time to also say, however, this is all conditional. And if you do not do this and the other, we certainly can't be there forever. You are going to have to reform. You're going to have to improve your institutions.
You have run out of time.
I have run out of time. I thought so. Okay. Thank you very much. I'll be glad to answer questions.
I have at least one and maybe more appeals from the panel to respond a bit, so I'm going to permit that as long as the panel will allow me to ask them to be brief about it before we take questions. But there are microphones set up, and we will stick with the order in which you line up at microphones for the questions. But I know Kim would like an opportunity to respond.
Hello. I realize that as the president of the Institute for the Study of War sitting here at the United States Institute of Peace, I'm representing a view that is necessarily thought extreme. But I've had both Colin and Rand attribute to me views that if I enunciated in the opening talk, I did not mean to, and I have been misconstrued. I do not think, however, that I enunciated them. First, I do want to say that I do believe that it is possible to reduce U.S. troop presence and to reduce it in 2009. I believe that I stated that. That, in fact, the issue here that we are discussing is precisely the question of when to reduce our forces, not whether to reduce our forces. And what I was arguing is that we have a great opportunity, but that we must not reduce our forces before the provincial elections occur, and indeed perhaps not before the national elections occur. And at that moment, it is almost certainly likely that we will be able to reduce our force presence and quite possibly to change our mission. But I think that the question of this matter of months is very important, precisely for the reasons that Rend laid out. The achievements that we have made have not yet resulted in sustainable stability. I agree with Colin and with Rend that that is exactly what we wish to achieve. I think the question then becomes, how best do we achieve that sustainable stability, and what do we need to do in the coming months to see to it that these impermanent conditions that we have set in political life actually take root and become the framework for civic discourse and civic life within Iraq? And what I disagree with firmly is that right now we should promise to withdraw U.S. forces from Iraq in 16 months, or indeed promise to withdraw them beginning now, precisely because I actually think that that will make less permanent the kinds of political changes that are nascent and underway. And I really do not think that I'm an optimist about what the situation is on the ground. I do not think that I'm either a Goldilocks or a mama bear, nor do I think that I am a glass overfull or a Pollyanna here. What I'm saying is that we have not yet accomplished our objectives, that our military forces contribute actually to the accomplishment of our objectives, that the next 6 to 8 to 10 months is critical for accomplishing our objectives, and that we should not prejudge the outcome of the political struggle or make a determination about force levels until we have actually achieved some of these conditions on the ground. Thank you.
I want to offer others on the panel an opportunity. Charles?
I wanted to respond to Colin's suggestion that what I advocate would leave Iraq a failed state, or at least a high probability of becoming a failed state. I believe that Iraq will continue to be politically unstable for a very long time, and a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with U.S. presence there or not. But political instability is not the equivalent of a failed state. And there are many ways to try to avoid an outcome of a failed state that do not include keeping our troops there indefinitely. So that's one point. I believe we must get over the notion that stabilizing Iraq is something that we can do. It is fundamentally about what Iraqis themselves do. And that's, I want to repeat that since U.S. intervention is a contributing factor to instability in Iraq, the best way to move towards a stable state is to move to outside support being handled by international agency. Once we announce a withdrawal plan, a firm and credible withdrawal plan from Iraq, Iraqi politics will no doubt change dramatically. But I believe anybody who says that they can predict a good or bad outcome of that change is really talking through their hat. I hope we've learned by now that Iraqi politics are deeply, deeply complex, and that we shouldn't be predicting a bad outcome of that. We could talk more about that, but that's where I'll leave that. Finally, I would just say that as one looks at the details of conditionality that are advocated, and I've spent some time over the last week looking at the details, we see that there are many, many aspects of a deep entwined dependency between changes in Iraq and U.S. presence there. And when you start considering that, you see that conditionality for withdrawal will, in fact, keep us there for decades to come, not just a few years, but decades to come. And it even makes me wonder about the intent of advocates. Is that what they want, keep us there for a very long time?
I'm going to beg Colin and Ren's indulgence not to respond at this moment, but to get to some questions and comments from the audience. Please.
Hello. My name is Sarah Shannon, and I am from...
Please speak up and into the microphone. Tell us who you are again.
My name is Sarah Shannon, and I'm from the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. My question pertains to the ongoing process of securing peace in Iraq, or to use the term that both Rand Alhim and Colin Call used, sustainable security in Iraq. My question is, how is the future of peace in Iraq affected by the ticking time bomb of 4.7 million displaced Iraqis, and what are the potential future effects of this deepening crisis, such as the numerous unmet needs of those with no access to livelihoods? And how do you see this affecting the future of peace in Iraq?
Rend?
Sorry, you're referring to the refugee population.
And the IDPs.
And the IDPs. Okay. There are two possible ramifications to this. One of them, of course, is that they are in both in Jordan and in Syria, particularly in Syria, large numbers of them are live in very poor conditions. And there is a breeding anger and resentment. And one of the dangers that we see is the radicalization of the most sort of the poorest of those communities. And they can be prey to kind of radical ideas, recruitment into both Sunni and Shia fundamentalist radical jihadi groups. That's one problem. The other problem is that, very quickly, and then I'll, the other, The other problem is that just as the in the 80s and 90s there grew up to be an opposition to the regime of Saddam Hussein, which sometimes, by the way, was violent in Iraq, and there were many bombings and so on, that the refugee community will then export its or take its resentment back into Iraq and form a disruptive element of opposition to the state and so on, and join jihadi groups on both sides of the religious spectrum. Colin?
Yeah, I agree with that, all of that. I would add that there are two domestic challenges in particular to resettling IDPs and refugees that should be highlighted. One is that part of the reason violence has come down has been the separation and segregation of certain mixed communities. As the security environment improves, people are going to want to come back to their homes. The problem is their homes are occupied by other people, typically from the group that pushed them out. So if there's not a way to establish property rights or to compensate individuals, you're going to have a lot of grievances and micro flashpoints for sectarian violence in places like Baghdad. I would caution, however, that we should resist our immediate humanitarian impulse to say that we should immediately reverse engineer mixed neighborhoods, because I think if we do that haphazardly, it'll cause more problems than it solves. So it may be better to compensate with housing elsewhere interim. The second issue, which I won't go into great detail, is figuring out a way to allow the IDPs to vote. So that you don't have 2 million, you know, a tenth of the Iraqi population disenfranchised by the fact that they've been forced to move as a consequence of the violence. So I'll leave it at that.
Could I just add
Please. Very
briefly? Yes, to both what Ren and Colin said, and I would point out that the refugees and IDPs represent a very important part of the strategic failure here in that it creates enormous bad will in the Arab world. And it's an enormous failure of U.S. policy that exists.
Kim, did I detect the desire to pitch
in? And finally, just 2 points. I think, Colin, that when you go to Iraq on your upcoming trip, you will see some of those frictions very much on the ground. You also see the Iraqi army settling and resettling and helping the resettlement of IDPs. I don't think that that's a perfect solution, but it is a process that's newly underway. And secondly, I think you will find that the voter registration mechanisms really do address the question of where individuals will vote precisely for the issues that you raise, which I think are quite valid.
I'll insert a commercial just to say that USIP has conducted a first seminar on property rights issues very recently.
Is that with the Cato Institute?
No.
That's a joke. They like property rights.
It's a joke.
Come on. Jeez, lighten up, people.
And we anticipate that this question of potential conflicts arising from displacement and refugees, including with their host countries, but also on their return to Iraq, we expect that to be a major focus of our programming for the next year or so. Please.
Good morning. My name is Lieutenant Stephen Bosco. I spent the bulk of 2007 in Anbar province working on Iraqi security force issues. Rent, the picture you presented of the Iraqi security forces was fairly grim, a little more grim than what I saw over there. I personally helped process thousands of Anbar Sunnis into the Iraqi army to serve under Shia officers. So I was just wondering along those lines whether the rest of the panel agreed with that presentation of the status of the Iraqi security forces, and whether you saw any changes recently in how the populace in general views the Iraqi security forces.
Kim, you've been there recently.
The Iraqi army in particular is a very well-respected institution, and it is well-respected by the people, regardless of where in Iraq I've asked the question. I've traveled with Iraqi security forces. In fact, I've had ISF as my personal security detail, which is a new and interesting phenomenon. I think the point is that when we look back to 2006, there's no question that there was a grave imbalance, a grave sectarian imbalance within the security forces, and in particular, even still within the Iraqi army. I think that the recruitment efforts over the course of 2007 have helped to rebalance the Sunni and Shia leadership and cadre within those armed forces. And I think that most interestingly, the recent operations in Basra have shown a very suspicious Prime Minister Maliki that, in fact, the Iraqi army as an institution can and will respond to his requests for reinforcement. When we think about it, it was not the Shia institutions of the Iraqi police that responded to the violence in Basra, but rather the Iraqi army. I believe that Prime Minister Maliki had many questions about whether that army would function as a coup force or whether that army would be responsive to his command and control. I think those questions may still be out there, but the evidence now presented by the Iraqi army is very much one of a professionalizing force responsive to civilian authority. The second thing I would say is that it is a professionalizing force. And one of the most remarkable things that I've seen on the ground in all of these trips over the past 14 months is that Iraqi officers and Iraqi soldiers want to be like us. That is to say, they want to have the same degree of professionalism as U.S. soldiers. And it's one of the reasons why I think our efforts in 2007 have been so successful, that we've partnered our U.S. forces at echelon, at command echelons, with these Iraqi soldiers and made it possible for them to emulate us. And it is one of the other roles that our brigades perform in the country that makes me concerned about withdrawing them too rapidly, because they are an impetus for the continued professionalization of the Iraqi security forces. So thanks for everything you've done in Anbar.
Anyone else, Colin?
Yeah, I think I want to thank you, too, for your service. It'd be interesting to track the data on integration in Anbar vice integration in Baghdad. And you're nodding your head, and you know what I'm talking about. The folks out in Anbar, as Maliki is considered, might as well be, you know, hillbillies from Kentucky. They're far away. They're strategically
Wait
peripheral.
A second.
If any of you are, I apologize in advance.
too late.
Apologize in retrospect. Maliki wasn't too concerned with the awakening in Anbar. As it spread to Baghdad and greater Baghdad and the surrounding mixed communities, he became much more nervous. And as I'm sure you know, in the summer of 2007, Petraeus and Crocker had to basically twist his arm almost all the way off to get him to agree to integrate a lot of these Sons of Iraq into the Iraqi security forces. And even then, the first experiment had to happen in Abu Ghraib, which is on the western outskirts of Baghdad, and it was only 1,500 guys. And even then, the Ministry of Interior did a bunch of stuff to slow roll that process, including trying to blame attacks on them that they didn't do so that they would be ineligible, including sending them to a police training station in eastern Baghdad so that they would have to cross through militia territory to go get trained. This government is not too psyched about the Sunni Sons of Iraq. And I think the old problem used to be paranoia. I think the new problem is overconfidence. I think the new problem with Maliki is that he doesn't think he needs these guys, and he thinks the ISF is strong enough that he can defeat them if they rise up and cause problems. But whether it's nervousness or whether it's strength or weakness that it's the problem, there's still a problem with integration. And I would agree with Rend. I don't think 20% has been reached. I don't think 20% is enough. And I don't think it's going to be the right 20%, even if it was enough. And then what do you do with the rest, the other 80%? The only other thing I would say about the Iraqi security forces is that, and this is to repeat something I said at the outset, we need to be very careful that when we're diagnosing the issues about sustainable stability moving forward, that it's about both capacity and will. The problem with our approach to the Iraqi security forces in 04, 05, 06 is that we rushed to build capacity and transition authority to them before they were ready, and that caused all sorts of problems. But the other problem was we didn't condition our assistance on to the army, the national police, and the police on them actually respecting human rights and the rule of law, which meant that basically they became sectarian death squads and accelerated the civil war. We can't repeat that problem in the future. I think the Kim is right that the Iraqi army is increasingly respected, all right? But it is also being increasingly used by the regime to accomplish certain political objectives. And I think if we're going to push the Maliki regime to integrate and make the Iraqi security forces more balanced and also not use them as a tool of sectarianism, we have to use strategic conditionality, not just the tactical conditionality that we've been using, which is why I argue for both enhancing their capacity but also making that support conditional.
I want to just make one short statement. I did say that the U.S. handled the Iraqi army in the reverse order in which it should have been handled, because it started with numbers and, undifferentiated, irrespective of who they were, and then moved on to, well, we need to teach them combat and so on. And then finally remembered, gosh, there's the issue of integration, professionalization. That was the last phase, which is now happening. But I want to make one small comment on what you said, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. Under Saddam's regime, all the recruits were Shia. All the commanders were Sunnis. And that is how Saddam kept control of the army. He needed large numbers in the army, and the large numbers had to come from the Shia. But he needed to keep them under abeyance. I'm not suggesting this is happening, but we need to be careful about the reverse happening now. And your statement, it struck me when you said you've recruited a lot of Sunnis who work under Shia commanders. It sounds good, but it raises a red flag simply because of our history.
Please.
Hi, I'm David Wood from the Baltimore Sun. I'd like to pursue a sort of a common thread among what you've all been saying, which is that there needs to be some kind of residual force, U.S. military uniformed force in Iraq, for some undetermined or some period of which you disagree. But I'd like to get at that sort of residual force, and especially in view of the fact that the political sentiment here now seems to be we're going to take troops out of Iraq and send it to Afghanistan. So I want to get at the question of how many troops you think we're going to need in Iraq. If you task them with training, mentoring Iraqi forces, pursuing counterterrorism operations, and doing the logistics support that they're doing now, which I would count in medical, intelligence, air support, as well as pure logistics, how many troops are you talking about?
Kim, I think you probably want to take that one.
I'm happy to take that one, but the first thing I will tell you is that I don't know the answer because I don't have a 1,000-man staff to do the troop to task. And I think it's very important to remember that as we discuss final footprints, that they are not, we don't determine how many soldiers are in a country pursuing a mission simply on the basis of it would be the best in our imaginations here in Washington to have, let us say, 75,000 soldiers on the ground in Iraq indefinitely, or 10,000 soldiers. We pursue that question by asking what is it that we need our troops to do, and then how many troops do we need in order to accomplish those objectives. And I would suggest that over time, the troop-to-task ratio will almost certainly go down as the Iraqi security forces become more capable. The question really is the level and the sort of slope of that drawdown. I would not rush right now to make any final determination. What I will tell you is what I've heard Iraqis say about what they need from the United States and the time frames that they request. You know, here in the United States, we often see a division between our civilian leaders and what they want or what they think is militarily possible and what our military leaders recommend on the basis of their assessment of the situation on the ground. We have the same thing, I think, going on in Iraq right now. Abdel Qadir, the Minister of Defense, does actually believe that the United States will need to continue to support Iraqi forces in their essentially in their role as an internal security force through about 2012. In decreasing numbers almost certainly over the course of those years, and that the United States will also then need to help the Iraqi security forces make the transition from an internal defense force to a force that's actually capable of defending Iraq against neighbors. And so we have to look at both of those tasks that lie ahead, realize that there will be a period of transition from one to the other, and realize that our troop-to-task ratio will be built upon not only this abstract number that we desire, but these actual responsibilities that we have and that Iraq's officials think that we should have in order to complete the transition to Iraqi control.
Charles, did you want an opportunity to comment on residual force questions?
Sure. Residual forces, hope it's clear that I'm not in favor of them being there, and I think we will not see resolution of or movement that we need to see on political level in Iraq until we're committed to being out totally. I've done some thinking about the residual force idea. Obviously, it's one around. Barack Obama has recently used the term, I think, so if he is elected president and decides to keep a residual force there, I have some guesses as to what that will mean. I mean, I would guess in 2009 he might draw down to about 75,000 troops in Iraq, and that the plateau would come at something like 50 or 60,000 troops. And that, you know, my position is clear, is if we as a nation to go on that kind of policy, we'll be there for a very, very long time at those kinds of levels, because you won't get resolution of the stuff that needs to be resolved. And the alternative is to begin planning now to replace U.S. troops with a very substantially different international a force of assistance to the Iraqis, something that they would invite in, obviously, that would be made up mostly of troops from Muslim nations. And that's something we could talk about more, but I doubt we'll have time to today. But that's the kind of thing that we need to be thinking about for the future, because I believe U.S. has to get out of there totally at some point in the not-too-distant future.
Colin?
I mean, in a sense, anybody who gives you a number on the residual force is making it up, okay? Because we don't know what the security environment's going to look like, and we don't know what the composition and size, therefore, will require of our residual forces. So what the next president will do is set the mission and the long-term strategic objective and draw down to some level which will be sufficient to accomplish that, and then to keep stepping down, as Kim suggests. I think I really caution the media to try to pin any politician down on the size of the residual force, because it's simply not what you would want a president to do. You would want the president to outline the mission and then go to his commanders or her commanders and have the right composition. A couple of things, though, and this touches back to the very beginning of the question. I think it's no longer in question whether there will be a withdrawal in 2009. There will be, and there's likely to be a significant one. Because of the strains on our ground forces and because of the demands in Afghanistan, it won't matter who is elected president. There will be a substantial drawdown starting in 2009. The question, therefore, politically, the interesting one is not whether we will draw down, but how we leverage that drawdown in our residual support to the Iraqi government to generate the type of political settlement that eventually allows us to leave altogether. And in that context, I want to highlight one thing that has not been mentioned. I agree with Charles. We should not have a permanent presence, and I view the residual force as a transitional presence. But I would actually go one step further. I believe that politicians that articulate a desire to have an enduring long-term or, say, Korea-style presence for decades, all right, is not only a bad idea, but it's actually disastrous to our leverage over the Iraqis. Mm-hmm. Because what it tells the Iraqis is our number one priority is to stay, which means we end up begging them to let us stay, as opposed to trying to get them to convince us not to leave. That's back-assward, all right? Our leverage comes from the support that I think at least Kim and I and Rand agree they need. We should be using that. But any signal that we intend to have a permanent presence is disastrous from a negotiating perspective, which comes back again that the messages and the signals at the strategic level that the administration sends the Iraqis are crucial to getting the kind of leverage that we need to actually have a reasonable outcome that advances our interests and the Iraqi interests.
I agree with Colin on that.
Colin, let me challenge you a little bit on conditionality because the questioners haven't done it yet. When you impose conditionality, you have to be willing to carry out the threat.
Agreed.
And, in many situations, he who imposes the conditionality becomes more prisoner than he on whom it's imposed. And you can easily see that happening. We impose conditionality, say we're gonna leave faster unless you do such and such. They don't do such and such. We leave faster. The situation deteriorates further. How do you avoid this kind of vicious cycle?
I think actually you have to be willing to take that risk. I mean, you can't compare the policy in a vacuum, though. You have to compare it to what an unconditional policy would likely do. There are risks with both. The risk with an unconditional policy is that you try to twist arms behind the scenes and those messages are undermined from the top because at the end of the day, none of your threats are credible. And I think that's the fundamental political flaw of the surge strategy. All right. I think the conditionality argument can be strawmanned as all in or all out. I'm not arguing that if they don't meet every benchmark, you pull out every last force, but you can slow roll assistance to the government. You can hold back critical enablers to the Iraqi security forces and let them fail every once in a while to keep in mind that there's a need for us, right? You can do or not do certain things in international diplomatic and economic fora that the Iraqis want. It's not an all-in or all-out model. It's called good diplomacy. But good diplomacy requires stuff at the micro level to hold for accountability, buttressed by a strategy at the macro level to make it clear that our support is not open-ended.
Kim, I was detecting you anxious to intervene.
I would. I actually think it's interesting, a really interesting question, what conditionality actually produces. And I have not actually seen any evidence over the course of our current relationship with Iraq, with this current administration, that any of our attempts at conditionality have actually produced the desired results. I think we have an assumption here that Colin is making, that the government of Iraq would be more responsive to U.S. Interests and indeed more likely to achieve the objectives that we, the United States, would like it to achieve if our support was conditional. What I actually see is that, on the whole, as we have increased our leverage within the Iraqi government, we have done so not by making our commitment conditional, but actually by making it more emphatic and more permanent. And so when we look at the reason why the surge produced those political changes that it has produced, I would argue that it comes from the fact that we were able, by our presence, to guarantee the security of the government of Iraq and also to guarantee the security of those who renounced violence and decided to opt for a political process instead. And so I have not seen any evidence so far that conditionality produces the result that we desire. Now, that does not mean that it's impossible for conditionality to produce those results, but I do actually wish that we had some evidence that it would. Secondly, I would say that this question of conditionality must be mitigated by the fact that the United States does have permanent interests in Iraq. That doesn't mean it needs to have a permanent presence. That's not what I'm arguing. It has enduring interests in Iraq. And we must not engage in conditionality such that we compromise the ability to achieve those interests by creating points of failure that are unacceptable. And so what I think needs to be done on the large scale is to understand that there are single points of failure in this system, and that the United States must not allow these single points of failure to occur, while nevertheless recognizing that there are other points within the system where there is an opportunity to leverage conditionality, and in those cases where there's redundancy or the prospect of creating a problem for the Iraqi government that is not fatal, by all means, we can use conditional means to do that, and we have on what Colin would call the tactical level. But I do actually think that those have long-term implications. Finally, I do want to say that the problems that we are having right now with the negotiation of the SOFA and the long-term security agreement have emanated from the fact that the Iraqi government asked for a security guarantee from the United States way back in January and February, and that the United States was not actually able to provide that security guarantee because it would not pass through the democratically inclined Senate. That is to say, it would not get a veto-proof majority. And so the question of conditionality is back on the table precisely because we've put it there, and that we have created, in some senses, the conditions for the Iraqis to engage in the discussions that Rand has mentioned.
Dan, I must respond to this. First of all, Kim, I'm sorry, but I really don't agree that conditionality has been better in producing the outcomes that we would like to see in Iraq, or lack of conditionality. I think the opposite is true, that by giving the Iraqi government a green light and full unconditional support, irrespective of what they do, has actually undermined Iraqi interests and U.S. interests. I'll give you an example of this. The United States has been trying very hard to get the Iraqi government to open up to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and other large Arab countries. The larger Arab countries have asked for certain assurances from the Iraqi government in order to resume normal, friendly relations. The Iraqi government has steadfastly refused to bend on any of the issues that the Saudis and the Egyptians have asked for. Is this in Iraqi interest? No. Is it in U.S. interest? No. Has the U.S. sanctioned the Iraqis? Has it said anything to the Iraqis about not opening up to the Arab world? No. I just bring this as an example, and we can multiply the examples. I don't think, really, that simply saying, we support you no matter what you do, is going to be good either for Iraq or for us.
And what I would say is that what we cannot do is then say that unconditional withdrawal
And exactly, that's the other point. We have predicated conditionality only on withdrawal of troops. And I think that's the problem, that all we think about is, if you don't do what we think is good for you and good for us, then we will withdraw troops. That is wrong. There is a whole array of other things that we can help them with or choose not to help them with. And this is what we need to focus on.
I am going to confess to the assembled that I've lost track of which side I'm on. But what I want to do now is take two questions at once, and I'm going to have to stop there. You want to go ahead first?
Hello, my name is Nick Harris from the Center for Global Peace at American University. I'd like to thank the panel members for speaking with us today. In April of this year, the U.S. Senate held a hearing on Iraq 2012. What can it look like and how can we get there? So very briefly, I'd like to ask each one of the panel members to give us their vision of what Iraq will look like in 2012.
That's a great question that we will finish with going through the panel, but let's take one more.
Yes, okay. Patricia Fagan, Georgetown University. Is this low enough? I'm low.
Yes, I don't know who set those microphones today, but it was somebody.
Neil O'Neill.
Yeah, something like that. The question derives from something Kim said at the very beginning, but the answer is not necessarily Kim's alone to address. At the very beginning, Kim, you made the point that the military should abandon its assumption that once elections take place, that this is the end of the game, that now we can simply say goodbye. And you raise the very realistic possibility that post-elections there are plenty of violence, either on the part of the people being elected, on the part of the people not being elected, and so on. There's potential for violence. But the question I have now is, in the post-election period, what is the military's role, which is somewhat different, I think, than the pre-election or than what has gone before, and can we disaggregate what is in the military's domain from what is in the other, from in domains that is that are not the military's domains? That is, what are the other issues to be undertaken by U.S. support? Because we can talk about Iraqis, but now we're talking about the U.S. role in Iraq. And one example, of course, would be the much-discussed integration of refugees, but one could name about a dozen more. That's the question.
Let me go back through the panel in reverse order that we began. Rand?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the election period, is going to run all through 2009. And I think the election campaign and the election process is going to be prone to a lot of violence. So the U.S. military role is very clear during that period. But if we're talking about post, I think we are going to have a problem of winners and losers. And this can be on different levels. Let us just take the microcosm, if you want, of Anbar province, which is an all-Sunni province. The contest now is between the Sahwas, the Sunni groups that emerged in 2006, and the established political Sunni parties, such as the Islamic Party of Iraq. Each one claims to represent the Sunnis, and there is a serious danger that if the elections do not satisfy one side or the other, of course everybody's armed to the teeth, but if the elections don't come out in favor of one or the other, the losing party may well feel disgruntled, may well take to arms, try to undermine the system. The other problem is a problem that we've had in Iraq since really 2003. This is that. So one problem is the violence and so on. The other problem is a political problem, and that is a problem of this majoritarian sort of thinking that we have suffered from in Iraq, that majorities are defined by sect, by religion, and so on. And the majority, and I see this happening under Maliki's government now, the sense of we're winning, we don't need to worry about the others. And one of the problems that could arise in 2009 is that you have a confirmation of a particular political order that is in place today, and if that is confirmed, then the disregard that the new order that sort of perpetuated by elections of 2009 is going to be very negligent about the needs of the rest of society. And that will create major discontents, which could again erupt into violence. So on the smaller level, provincial level, and on the national level, we have two different types of problems that the military or U.S. presence could help with.
Rand, a sentence about Iraq in 2012?
Oh, good grief. You know, a great deal, I'm sorry to say, is going to depend on U.S. policy. And this is why we have to think extremely carefully about it. I don't think we can talk about Iraq in 2012 without thinking of what the U.S. intends to do, is willing to do, and so on.
Colin?
I agree with that, although I think the theme of 2009 will be managing our increasing irrelevance. That is, I think the next president will inherit the beginning of the post-American world in Iraq. And the challenge will be for the next president to capitalize on the diminishing levers that we have to get a few things important accomplished, which are necessary to put Iraq on the road to sustainable stability. And I think in that context, it's why I've put so much emphasis on combining both tactical and strategic conditionality. And Kim, to disagree with you on a point you made about 5 minutes ago, there is evidence that conditionality has worked at the tactical level. For example, there is much evidence that in slow rolling or cutting off support to targeted units within the National Police and the Iraqi Army, we have influenced their behavior, including replacing commanders, put pressure on the government, etc. But The problem is, if you talk to a lot of our military commanders and diplomats, they will tell you that those messages are undermined by a strategic environment in which overall support to the Iraqi government is not conditioned on everything. This is not me making it up. In the new Linda Robinson book, which comes out in September, which I pitched, I didn't write it, so I don't have an interest in it, other than I think she's right, is that, quotes Khalilzad, quotes, and most of her interviews are from Team Petraeus. And Kim, you know, we were at a dinner the other night with a senior military official who will go unnamed because it was off the record, and without divulging too much of what the dinner, there was clear agreement that the absence of strategic level conditionality undermined our ability, right, to influence the Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi government. So I would argue for marrying the stuff we're already doing tactically with an overall strategic picture that uses our diminishing leverage.
Charles?
Okay, a hopeful vision of Iraq in 2012. The U.S. has left Iraq militarily. It has, as a result, there has been movement toward a national accord, helped out by a group of contact states. The U.S. plays a major diplomatic role in organizing. There has been a ramp up in international agency and support of Iraq. The U.S. has contributed in many ways, financially and otherwise, to help with the refugee problem, funds to employ 500,000 Iraqis who badly need jobs, which is, of course, a underlying aspect of the discord there. And the U.S. has moved to change its relationship with regional powers, including Syria and Iran, gaining as a result their support for peace and reconciliation in Iraq. And, go on, but in the interest of time, I'll stop there, but I do want to say that as long as the U.S. stays in Iraq, the goal of national reconciliation and peace in Iraq will recede into the time horizon like a mirage in the desert.
Kim.
I agree emphatically with Rend on her statements about the role of the United States military after the provincial and national elections, and also her statement that the future of Iraq and the majority of the question about the future of Iraq rests on our decision of U.S. policy. And so the vision that one has of Iraq in 2012 is highly contingent upon what it is that the United States decides to do next. Does it decide to enable the Iraqi government to integrate into the world community by through its actions? Does it ally with Iraq as it might against the threat of global terrorism and indeed against the common threat of Iran? Is the Iraqi security force actually capable of providing internal security in 2012? And have we set the conditions between 2008 and 2012 for a series of provincial elections that will, in fact, reduce the possibility for a violent conflict and also reduce the possibility for the domination of a single sect or party? Those are the questions that we have in front of us, and I do believe that what the United States military does, and indeed what the United States does with all of its instruments of policy over the coming years, really will make the most substantial difference in whether Iraq actually achieves the sustainable security that we hope it will, or whether it devolves into civil conflict. And so the choice in many respects is ours.
I want to thank the panel. I think we've performed our proper function of being a big tent for a wide-ranging discussion, and I hope you'll join me in thanking them as well.